From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
The first day they screamed at us, no Spanish, English only. And I got so scared I peed in my pants. And that was our introduction into the American school system of English only.
A writer remembers his childhood, navigating the choppy waters between English and Spanish. Today, a look at the cultural balancing act for Latinos in the United States. What to hold on to and what to leave behind. One comedian introduces us to Mexico's greatest comic, Cantinflas.
In the Spanish-speaking world, Cantinflas is definitely the most recognized name in cinema, no doubt about it.
Also, why jazz might have Latin roots hiding behind its purely American facade.
Jelly Roll Morton, of course, a great jazz pioneer, piano player from New Orleans, always said that if it didn't have what he described as a Spanish tinge, then it wasn't jazz.
Victor Villaseñor is one of America's most acclaimed writers, but he didn't get there without a few bumps along the way. Going to school was hell. In his memoir, Burro Genius, Villaseñor talks about the abuse he suffered as a Latino in an English-only school system and what it took to heal him of his shame and anger. He says there couldn't have been a bigger disconnect between his idyllic home life and his first day in school.
I grew up on a ranch. And inside the gates of the ranch, everybody spoke Spanish, and I had friends that would come over there, and my best friend was my dog and my horse and my family, and, you know, we'd milk cows and make homemade cheese. I had a chair up in a loquat tree. That's a fruit, and I'd eat loquats and just reach around the tree and eat till my belly was full. It was just like growing up in paradise, and there were deer and fox and coyotes, and I knew where all these animals lived, right next to the ocean. We'd go horseback riding. But then going to school was the nightmare.
So for you, going to school was like being kicked out of the Garden of Eden?
Absolutely. I mean, the first day they screamed at us, no Spanish, English only. And I got so scared I peed in my pants. And then I ran out the door with the other kids, and we were trying to figure out what to do, and we're talking in Spanish, and the playground teacher came in and said, you already told, no, Spanish, English only. And I peed in my pants again. I was so scared. And one kid said, don't be yelling at me. You're not my mother. And then she grabs him, and he said, let go of me. You don't have the right to be grabbing me. And she started slapping him, and then he cussed her out in Spanish, and she slapped him until he was bloody. And that was our introduction into the American school system of English only.
Of course, it didn't make you feel very good about any possible connection to American society.
Well, actually, that's not what happened. It's the opposite. When my mother picked me up that afternoon, I hated my mother. I didn't like her anymore because she had left me there. And when I got home, I didn't trust my father anymore because he told me school would be fun for me because everybody loved Mexicans and we were great people. And I realized my parents were fools. So what happened was, I began to hate my culture, not like or trust my parents, learn English at the price of having my spirit crushed. And that's why I have the title Burro Genius of the book.
What does it mean to you, the Burro Genius?
Well, I give talks around the country, and when I ask kindergarten kids, how many of you are geniuses? They all raise their hand. One kid flipped on the floor and raised both legs up in the air, both arms, and I said, boy, you're really a genius. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm really a genius. I said, how do you know? He said, oh, look what I do. And he showed me his finger paintings. And you know, by the third grade, there are not many geniuses. And by the fifth grade, no kid raises their hand. They've been crushed, intimidated. And genius doesn't mean smart. If you look it up in the dictionary, genius means guardian deity, spirit of a person, natural ability. According to ancient Roman belief, a guardian spirit assigned at birth.
So what our school system does is try to get rid of the native genius.
Exactly. And they did it not just to me and the black kids. They do it to all the white kids. By fifth grade, we have A students that just memorize information and test well and memorize more information and test well. But the ability to think, to dream, to access, as Christ said, the kingdom of God is within us all. And when we access that, we're accessing our genius. And Emerson said, when we bring what's within out into the world, miracles happen. So our educational system is destroying our genius all over. And so what my book's about is about not just a Mexican kid, about all of us getting back our spirits.
It's good that you feel this way, but it's clear that the way you tell the story, that a lot of it was fueled by racial hatred. That there was more of this for you and the black kids and the other Mexican kids than there was for the Anglos in the class.
Oh, absolutely. I was told by the playground teacher, you know, white is right, and you're not white. You don't even belong here. You belong south of the border. There's no purpose in even going to school. You're never going to amount to anything. And she believed it. And they would punish us and hit us and treat us really horrible.
And your friend Ramon, who said, no, you can't do that to me, how long did he continue to fight back?
He fought back, and they kept hitting him. And by the seventh grade, he was dead. And boy, I'll start crying. So the kids that did, the Mexican kids that did the best growing up were the ones that stopped calling themselves Mexicans. They kept saying that they were really Spanish, that they were really French, that they weren't Mexicans. It's the ones that denied who we were and denied our culture and tried every way they could to join the American mainstream European base mentality.
But it's clear you also managed to learn what you'd call your real heritage. The way you talk about what you learned from your father, your mother, your brother, the ranch hands, it makes it pretty clear that if only in the summers you learned what your heritage had to teach you.
It was all summer, every vacation, every weekend, and every afternoon. And I learned incredible things like this. Like in English, you say, let's break the horse. And they do it to horses, too. They break the spirit. In Spanish, the word is amansar. That means to make tame. And the guys from Mexico, they would take a young colt, and they wouldn't jump on it and beat it and make it buck. They would brush it and wash it and bathe it and pick up its hoofs, and the horse got to trust them. And then they'd put a blanket on it, and they'd walk it around. And pretty soon, that horse loved them. And then we'd put a saddle on it and lead it around with nobody on it. Then somebody on it, we'd lead it between two horses. And pretty soon, that horse was being reined and trained, and he never bucked once. And their whole purpose is, this way you never break the spirit of an animal. And when you have a horse that his spirit isn't broken, you can be running along, and all of a sudden the horse will put on its own brakes because it's thinking in its own, and stop, and won't go any further. And why? Because you didn't see it. There was either a hole there, some quicksand, or barbed wire, and you have a partner in life that will save your life. But when you take a horse and you just break its spirit, then it will just jump off a cliff with you or anything and won't protect you. So it was a whole philosophical difference that I saw, the way we treated animals, the way we treated trees. Like, we would make ceremonies before we took a tree down. So in other words, I was being taught all this ethics about life and death and everything. And then at school, it was a whole different education.
In some ways, you tell the story over and over again in different ways. You were denied all sorts of things. You were beaten in school. But all the time, you seem to have maintained within yourself a sense of your own value. When the other writers wouldn't stand up and talk, you said that you would. When you were beaten in school and were held back, you didn't fail. You didn't allow yourself to be crushed somehow. Is that your family coming out? Is that your heritage? Is that what you were taught at home?
That's absolutely my parents, my family, and my culture, because my father and my mother lived through the Mexican Revolution, through starvation. My father was 10, my mother was 7. They saw their sisters beaten and raped and killed, and they never gave up because they have the indigenous Indian belief that creation didn't happen. They have no nouns in indigenous language. Everything's a verb, so creation didn't happen. It's still happening. And in such a world, you don't believe in God, you do God. When you walk in beauty, you're doing God. When you're in harmony, you're part of God. When you find peace, you are God. You're Godding. So my parents and their mother's faith in God is indestructible. And mañana es otro milagro de Dios. Tomorrow's another miracle of God's. Y con el favor de Dios, with the favor of God. That's all they ever say. It's outside their mentality to ever say God has forsaken us and it's the end of the world, because there is no end. There are no beginnings. We're always right here, completely in union. We never lost the Garden of Eden. We're still gardening. We were sent here to plant the seeds. So I was taught all these things, and that we're not put here to rule the animals and the earth. We're here to harmonize with. And so it's a whole different point of view. The world is wonderful no matter what disaster happens, and it's full of love. And in romance songs, they say, que sabrosas son las lágrimas, how delicious are the tears of sadness, for they touch the heart and we still know that we're alive. This indestructible passion of wanting to live.
You know, but as beautiful as these things are, and they clearly are, and the passion with which you write about them is also obvious, they didn't serve you in some of the worlds you had to enter. In the Catholic schools, for instance, you write later in the book about trying to explain to one of the nuns about the two Bibles, and it didn't get you anywhere.
No, it got me slapped, beaten up again, and locked in a closet with the brooms and told I was the devil. Because my grandmother told me that there was a story for girls and a story for boys. There were two Bibles, and boys and girls are very different, so they each need their different story of creation. And then she also told me that originally there were two planet Earths, and that the Great Flood happened on the other one. And it was this huge ship that brought people from the other planet to here, 80,000 people or something, and that they interbred with their cousins here, the mud people, and that all of us are stardust and we're walking stars, five-pointed stars, and that we're connected to the universe and to all these other star systems of star people, and that we're helping God plant the seeds here. That's why we were sent to Earth. Not that the garden we lost, it's our job to plant it, and that's why we're here. So it was a whole different, and it sounded so beautiful to come across the universe as a child gathering stardust to be born, and then when we pass over, we don't die, we go back sprinkling stardust across the heavens of what we learned.
So you were taught one thing at home and then told in school that that was all wrong and that even thinking that made you bad. How did you overcome that conflict? How did you merge those two things at all to find your place in the world?
It took me till the age of my 50s and 60s. The first 5 years that I wrote, I had so much hate and rage. I didn't learn to read. I'm dyslexic, off the charts. I didn't learn to read till I was 20. So everything that had been crushed in my spirit here in the American school system, when I went to Mexico and I started living with Indians and seeing things, I began to see that, did you know that the is European-based, only European-based?
No.
The word the?
What do you use in place of it?
In indigenous languaging and all Asian languages and Russian, there's only that tree over there and this tree to give location. There is no the tree. That was invented by the Jews and then popularized by the Greeks. So I learned in Mexico, there is no the truth. There's only your truth, my truth, our agreed upon truth. And once I found that out, I began to see that it's okay to have many different opinions about things and many different points of view. And it took me literally to write this book, about 100 drafts, to finally harmonize these two worlds, because there's even a bigger way to look at it. My parents come from a world that's pre the Bible, that's pre-Jewish European. My grandmothers were both indigenous, one from Oaxaca and one a Yaqui. You know, my parents were born before the automobile, before all these things. And by the time they passed away just recently, they had been in jet airplanes. They knew about computers, TV. 100 years of such incredible growth they saw, and they came from a thinking that was pre-Garden of Eden. So for me, if I can just record their stories right, if I can just get it off, it's like I'm going to languages back to, they say we ate of the tree of knowledge and lost the Garden of Eden. Well, what did we eat? Let's spit it out and start all over again. That's what I'm writing.
Victor Villaseñor is the author of Burro Genius. He lives in Oceanside, California. Still to come this hour, A Tale of Two Tongues.
I can't not write it like I hear it. Esta mi chicana code-switching life right here in La Cuenca de Los Angeles.
Adventures in Spanglish later this hour. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Some people call jazz musician John Santos the Latin Renaissance man. Based out of San Francisco, Santos is one of the world's leading exponents of Afro-Latin music and the leader of John Santos and Machete. Santos has numerous albums to his name and has recorded with superstars like Dizzy Gillespie and Tito Puente. Santos told Steve Paulson that American jazz can be traced back to the Latin roots that found their way to New Orleans.
One, two, diggy, diggy, do.
First thing is just to look at the history of the Caribbean, that all the major ports of the Caribbean, including New Orleans, are connected for hundreds of years, economically, socially, culturally, politically. So as a result of that, there's always been movement between all those ports, which is why the Caribbean has this certain character that it has, which is a Creole place. And if you go to any of those major ports, you find the similarities. You see this Creoleness in the food, in the way that people look, in the music, in the rhythm. And the rhythm is an important one in New Orleans, because New Orleans carries a certain feel in their music that in the Caribbean is identified as clave. But most people, you know, relate clave with Cuban music and with Latin American dance music traditions. But it's really a pan-Caribbean phenomenon, and it's very present in New Orleans, although it's not talked about that much and it's not noticed because the clave is played on European instruments in the States, whereas it's played on African-derived instruments in the Caribbean. But it's there. If you listen to the second line music in the Mardi Gras, they have that accent, which is very easy to hear the clave. You know, they play that.
What about if you go back to some of those old New Orleans jazz musicians, King Oliver or Louis Armstrong? Do you hear it there?
Most certainly. They were very in tune with what was going on in the Caribbean, because not only did they travel in the Caribbean, but they also were exposed to a lot of Caribbean musicians who came to New Orleans to play, especially in the post-slavery period, going from toward the end of the 19th century and into the 20th. You had this incredible migration, in particular black migration into the urban areas, as well as a migration following seasonal work throughout the Caribbean of cutting cane and harvesting coffee and what have you. So you end up with people from all over the islands going to the various places for this seasonal work. So they were exposed to musicians from all over. And Louis Armstrong, one of his biggest and earliest hits was The Peanut Vendor, which is a Cuban song, El Manicero. Jelly Roll Morton, of course, a great jazz pioneer, piano player from New Orleans, always said that if it didn't have that Spanish tinge, what he described as a Spanish tinge, which is a syncopated rhythmic feel in the left hand when you play piano, then it wasn't jazz. So it's like one and two and three and four and one and two. And so it has that syncopation, and that's what they would put in the left hand, that one and two and three and four, one and two and three. And that is the Latin flavor that really identifies a lot of New Orleans music.
Now, I'm somewhat familiar with the Cuban roots of jazz, but I don't tend to think of Puerto Rican music as jazz.
Well, you know, again, the connections, the historical connections are the easiest way to see it, because the Puerto Rican community is the first Latin community in New York City. And where were they put? They were put in Harlem. The first community, the barrio in New York, is in Harlem. So these Puerto Ricans, who were black and of color mostly, who lived in Harlem, you know, experienced, they were in the middle of the whole Harlem Renaissance, and they saw and they participated in that thing that was going on in the arts there in black music. Also, Puerto Rican musicians were very much in demand, because the band leaders, the black band leaders of the day, sometimes would have trouble finding musicians because traditionally black musicians did not have too much access to formal training in this country in comparison to a place like Puerto Rico, where in Puerto Rico they have what's called bandas municipales, which are municipal bands or orchestras. Every little town has one. So if you show a little promise as a kid, you go to these places, they provide you with music lessons and an instrument. And so a lot of the musicians went to New York City were very, very highly trained musicians who could play, you know, Sousa marches and stuff from the military tradition, the European classical repertoire that they learn in these bands, but also typical Caribbean music, which is mostly in Puerto Rican in this case, but that's also very akin to Cuban music. So the Puerto Rican connection is one that, again, is kind of invisible, but it's there from the, you know, early on.
It is true that I think when you tend to think about Latin American influences on jazz, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is bossa nova, but it's sort of that earlier history. And it was very prevalent in the jazz world, especially, say, in the 1930s and 40s, wasn't it?
Certainly. I think the important thing is to look at the common roots, because the Latin music, the Afro-Latin Caribbean music and jazz have the same roots. So they're really branches, you know, of the same tree. And when they come back together, it's not like a novel or a new thing. It's very logical that they work together. You know, if we look at Mario Balsa, who came in 1930 to New York City, and within 2 or 3 years, he was the musical director of the Chick Webb Orchestra. And they're playing straight-ahead jazz of the day, swing, and one of the premier orchestras, and the musical director was a Cuban. You know, he brought in Dizzy Gillespie to that group to sub for him. He brought Dizzy to the Cab Calloway Orchestra. He brought Ella Fitzgerald to the Chick Webb Orchestra. You know, a seminal figure. And there's a lot of cases like that. Juan Tisol, also a trombonist from Puerto Rico, who was a big part of the Duke Ellington Orchestra and wrote Caravan and wrote some of the hits that Duke had that was coming from that side. And there's so many examples of that.
Duke Ellington's tune. What were you trying to do there?
Yeah, we have, I think, an interesting arrangement there. Wayne Wallace, who is a wonderful trombonist himself and composer and arranger, made that arrangement for us, adapted it for us, and it's, you know, it's just a tribute to that tradition of the Puerto Rican, the Caribbean roots of jazz.
Talked about some of the key figures in the history of jazz and how they incorporated Latin rhythms into their music. One was Dizzy Gillespie, and he hired, for instance, a drummer who has since become legendary, Chano Pozo. Tell me about him.
Yeah, well, Chano ties into this in so many ways. Chano was introduced to Dizzy by Mario Balsa, so that name comes up again. And Chano Pozo was a person who really, in a very short time, revolutionized what was going on with, you know, just bringing authentic, real, traditional roots of Afro-Cuban rhythm into jazz.
Well, and part of the fascination with him is his personal story. Apparently, he was a pretty tough guy.
Yeah, he was a character with a reputation coming from the ghetto, so to speak, in Havana. But was already very well known as a composer, choreographer, because he worked with the carnival groups and did choreography for them in Havana, and a drummer and vocalist. And he had several hits already when he came to New York and was, you know, seeking to further his career. And hooking up with Dizzy turned out to be phenomenal. In that 1 year and a half that he was with Dizzy's orchestra, they did a lot of touring. They toured throughout the states in the South and the West Coast. They toured in Europe. They made several recordings. And they really, you know, put a big shot in the arm there. That's a big milestone. A lot of people consider that to be the beginning of the marriage of Cuban and jazz. I don't quite look at it that way. I think it goes back a lot further than that, but that's certainly a huge milestone. And Dizzy always just the visionary up till his death. You know, I had the great honor of being able to record and play with Dizzy, and he just up to the end just, you know, sounded great on his horn and was always just very innovative and always saw Latin America and Latin music as a frontier of jazz, as a very important part of it. And one of the last great things he did, of course, was to form that United Nations Orchestra made up of musicians from all over Latin America. And he saw that as appropriate for jazz. That's what it was about. You know, a lot of purists, you know, tend to not want to go that way. And, you know, I've heard some sentiment of, you know, well, this is like the only thing that's really ours, and they feel like it might be being appropriated. But I think that's a result of this kind of conquer and divide mentality that has been put upon us all. We've been denied, I think, the truth about, you know, where some of these roots of jazz come from.
John Santos is one of the world's leading exponents of Afro-Latin music and the leader of John Santos and Machete. This is their tune, El Africán. To the best of our knowledge, producer and commentator Veronica Rickert knows what it's like to find the common ground between two cultures. For years, she denied her Mexican half before making peace with her heritage. Then a surprise phone call changed everything.
When I was growing up with my mom in various small towns in Wisconsin and Illinois, people would ask me, "What are you?" I understood that a human being, a girl, a runner-up in the Harvard Milk Day Parade was not the answer they were looking for. They were talking about my nationality. The truth was, I was Latina. I didn't even know what the word meant then. When a friend from college mentioned Chicano studies, I barely knew enough to correct her. My mother met my father and fell in love on a study abroad program in Puebla, Mexico. But things happened. She went back to the States. He said he'd join her and never did. She fell out of love, and I was born. During the 80s, when I was growing up in rural Wisconsin, nobody was Hispanic. So I told people I was Italian. "You look Italian," they'd reply. I'd tell them I was Greek. "You look Greek," they'd reply. I got gutsy. I told them I was Romanian. "You look Romanian," they'd always say. The truth was, I was ashamed of being Mexican. That all started to change the summer before I went to college. We got a weird phone call. It turned out to be the phone call. It was about my father, who I hadn't seen in 16 years. My father, who used to take my mother out to dinner, then sneak out the door without paying. My father, who inhabited my memory solely through a handful of Polaroids that turned up in a desk. He was dead. Complications from polio. There would be no reunions on Oprah for us. A private investigator had found us a little bit too late. Two years later, my mother took me to Mexico to meet the family I'd never known. I'd never even been on a plane before. That summer, in Mexico, I learned what became of my father, what we had in common, namely singing, opening the refrigerator doors of strangers, and freakishly good teeth. My Mexican family got a little carried away. "You enjoy breathing? So did your father," they'd joke. My father's family was wonderful and warm, and when I got married 2 years ago, most of them were there. Through them, I found out what might have been if the cards had been dealt a little differently. Turns out, my father became a successful businessman and set up his brothers and sisters in nice two-story houses on a quiet street in Puebla, lined with bougainvillea. My father's sister pointed out the one he picked up for my mom and me. It was a weird feeling, taking a tour of my life, the alternate ending, like a Christmas carol with mole. I didn't grow up in Mexico, and I didn't grow up with my father. But sometimes, when I sing or brush my perfect teeth, or bug my host by snooping in their frigid air, it feels like I did.
Commentator and TT Book producer, Veronica Rickert. For more information about the books and music featured on To the Best of Our Knowledge, stop by our website at www.ttbook.org and drop us a note while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, we meet Cantinflas, the Mexican comic so famous he inspired a new word.
You know, cantinfliando or cantinfliar is an actual verb now.
I'm Jim Fleming. That's next on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We get lots of email through our website at ttbook.org. After listening to The Desert, Alan from Decatur, Illinois wrote, "Today Steve Paulson said of Edward Abbey that he was a great anarchist thinker. That's an oxymoron." And after the American Roots Music Show, Jeff from Green Bay, Wisconsin wrote that he'd heard Bobby Braddock's song called Thou Shalt Not Kill. He wanted to know where he could get more information. Jeff, it's an unreleased song, so you'll have to listen again on the web to hear it. You can send us email at ttbook.org. The name Cantinflas isn't as well known in America as in Mexico and Latin America, but to some, Cantinflas is the Latin Charlie Chaplin. He broke box office records with his quirky trademark comedy. Admirers call him a genius at physical comedy, and his monologues are famous for saying, well, just about nothing. Here's a taste from actor Herbert Siguenza.
Compañeros, hay momentos en la vida que son verdaderamente momentáneos. Y no es que uno diga, sino que hay que ver y que vemos. Pues eso es lo que hay que ver. Porque qué casualidad, compañeros, que poniéndose en el caso donde no hay caso, pues mejor nos vamos a la que sigue, ¿verdad? Pero eso sí, hay que reflexionar, hay que comprender la filosofía de la vida y así analogar la síntesis de la humanidad, ¿verdad? Sí, señor, pues ahí está el detalle, jóvenes, ¿cómo la vieron desde ahí? ¡Oh!
Cantinflas on his philosophy of life. It's an excerpt from the one-man play written and performed by Herbert Siguenza. Siguenza told Anne Strangechamps that Cantinflas, whose real name was Mario Moreno, was an incredibly influential comic who made his mark in the United States as well.
Cantinflas is best known in America, anyway, for playing the ballet, David Niven's ballet in Around the World in 80 Days, the original film from 1955. It won the Oscar for 1956. With David Niven, Shirley MacLaine's in it, Frank Sinatra, Buster Keaton. So it's a lavish film by Mike Todd.
And he plays Passepartout.
Yeah, he plays Passepartout. And he basically steals the film. I mean, he's just wonderful in it because he was a wonderful physical comic. However, in Mexico, he's not known so much as a physical comic, but more as a verbal kind of comic, much like Groucho Marx was. In Mexico, he was already a superstar. He had already filmed, you know, 40-something films. Altogether, he filmed 51 films in his life from 1936 to about his last film to 1982. So he had a long, you know, 40, 50-year career of making films. Mm. I mean, in the Spanish-speaking world, Cantinflas is definitely the most recognized name in cinema. No doubt about it.
Didn't I read somewhere that Charlie Chaplin really admired him?
Charlie Chaplin saw his films. They became friends, and Charlie Chaplin called him the greatest comedian ever born. Mm. You know, he was at that height. You know, Charlie Chaplin was internationally known. Well, Charlie Chaplin was easy to understand because he didn't speak. And so I think Cantinflas never crossed over in America because of the language barrier. I really believe that.
What did he look like?
He based his character off Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp, but it was the Mexican version of El Peladito. And El Peladito means tramp, and it means someone with nothing. He was the everyman, you know, of Mexico. He had a typical getup, you know, his pants were baggy pants, black, below the waist, dangerously below the waist. They were almost like showing his behind. He had a white shirt. He had a little red handkerchief, a little hat that didn't quite fit right, folded like a taco, I'd like to say. And he always had this like little mustache on the side there, just a slight hint of a mustache on the side of his mouth. And so he was a recognizable character. And Mexico, especially the underclass of Mexico, really identified with this character of El Peladito.
Hmm. Did you ever actually see him perform live?
No. By the time I was growing up, he was pretty old already. And I just saw his like last movies were still showing in the movies. But I never saw him live. I never met the man. I wish I had, but I hadn't.
So what have been the challenges involved in creating a one-man play and becoming Cantinflas yourself?
I think when you tackle an icon like Charlie Chaplin or whoever, of that stature. I mean, we all have an opinion about this character, right? We all love him at a certain way. And so everyone knew Cantinflas intimately, probably, you know, from seeing all these films. So everyone has an opinion, an image of this character. And so, you know, you better be ready to portray him right and accurately. Otherwise, people, you know, will turn on you. But I've received nothing but accolades about my performance for him. And I just really have studied him and I really have taken on his spirit. You know, I'm not him. I'm just taking on his spirit, you know, and it's enough for people to relax and enjoy the show.
Well, don't you think also that if you're drawn enough to somebody that you want to do a one-person show about them, there's an awful lot you and that person must have in common?
Yes, I think I do have a lot in common with Cantinflas. He was a very, although he was a comic, he was a humanitarian. I mean, he hated ignorance, you know. He was a union organizer. He was a man of consciousness. He really was. He founded many orphanages. Because he was very wealthy. He was one of the wealthiest actors in the world in the 50s. And he used his money for good causes. He even founded La Casa del Actor, the House of the Actor, which was a retirement home for film workers, both actors and behind the scenes. And so he was really an important figure in Mexican politics and the social scene.
What did you want to get across to audiences about him? Did you just want people to know who he was or something more?
Yeah, since his death, I think people have forgotten Cantinflas a little bit. I mean, you can see his movies on Telemundo every night. They show him. But I think there's a new generation that's growing up here, the second generation of Mexicans and Latinos. And these kids don't know who Cantinflas is. You know, they know who, Will Smith is, and they know who Jim Carrey is. But I wanted to show them that, hey, we also have a hero, a comic hero. We have someone that was as big as Charlie Chaplin, and we should remember that. I mean, he was one of the first crossover stars that we had.
What do you actually do on stage? What do people see?
I go through his whole life from his early years. He was born in 1911, a year after the Mexican Revolution. And I talk about him joining a vaudeville tent show, like what they call carpas. These are vaudeville shows that travel around Mexico. In the early 1930s, he started doing traveling vaudeville comedy. And then in 1936, he filmed his first movie. I mean, he got discovered like quickly, like in 3 years. He only did like theater for 3 years, and then he became a movie star in 1936. And by 1940, he filmed a very important film called Ahí Está el Detalle, which translates roughly to There's the Rub, and that made him a star. And then after that, he filmed, like I said, 51 movies, and two in English. He did Around the World in 80 Days, and he did a film that flopped called Pepe.
Most of your plays in Spanish, right?
Yes, and I intentionally wanted to do it in Spanish because that's how he performed it. You know, he performed it in Spanish, and the verbal antics that he used are for Spanish. You can't translate it, you know? It would lose a lot in translation.
Why?
Well, for example, I go on in Spanish, and then I this is what I say in the middle of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I will switch to English just to show you that although I have been speaking in Spanish, I haven't been saying much at all. No, señor. I've been cantinfliando. And what is that, you say? Pues cantinfliando is a bunch of words put together to pass the time. And like Einstein said, time is relative. And quite frankly, I don't have the time or the relatives. But don't blame me. Blame it on the sunshine. Blame it on the moonlight. Blame it on the boogie. Oops, I did it again. Now you're probably saying, what the heck did he just say? But that's what I've been trying to say all along, that cantinflas is impossible to translate into English. Therefore, with your permission, we will now go back to Spanish. Bye-bye. So, you know, cantinfliando or cantinfliar is an actual verb now. It's an actual verb in the Spanish dictionary, which means to say a lot without saying anything at all. Mm-hmm. And so he had these outrageous monologues that would go on for 5 minutes, hilarious, but they weren't saying anything. So, it's hard to translate that because it's full of double entendres. It's play with words, you know. It's like Groucho Marx. I mean, you know, you can't translate Groucho Marx into Chinese. It just wouldn't work, you know?
I've heard that when the play opened in Houston, a couple of people came who had actually known Cantinflas, including his ex-wife. That must have been an amazing experience.
It was truly amazing. I was a little nervous, you know, because his dentist was here, his doctor, you know. He lived here in Houston for 12 years. You know, he had medical difficulties and he had his doctors here. And yes, Joyce Jett, his former wife, came, and she said to me, you know, I came to the play to hate it, because I didn't think anyone could capture the spirit of Mario Moreno Cantinflas. And she did come with crossed arms the first night, and then at the end of the night, she came up to me and said, this was amazing, I loved it. And she came again the following week, and she gave me his sunglasses, his glasses.
Which
was like, wow. It really touched me. And I actually wear those glasses now on stage.
Actor Herbert Siguenza, speaking with Anne Strangechamps. Siguenza is the author and star of the one-man play Cantinflas. With the Latino population of the United States growing every year, it seems only natural that a fusion of language take place alongside a cultural melding. To some, the linguistic result of this demographic change is Spanglish. Some people think the part Spanish, part English idiom will be the next dominant language. Some think it isn't a language at all. In any case, Susana Chavez-Silmerman fell in love with Spanglish, or code switching, as she calls it, in her memoir Killer Crónicas. It's being called one of the first Spanglish memoirs in print. She told Steve Paulson she started writing in Spanglish when she was living in Argentina, writing letters to friends.
When I was writing these letters to people, they wrote me back and said, this is exactly how you talk. Hmm. You know, keep doing it.
Well, why do you like going back and forth between English and Spanish?
To me, language is only one of multiple identity vectors, and I don't think you have to speak Spanish in order to be Latino or Latina. For me, I feel this expresses the realest me, or really expresses my personality. But I switch back and forth because I can. I had the privilege of being brought up bilingual, and I teach Chicano Latino studies, Latin American studies. Not all of my Latino or heritage students grew up bilingual. So to me, it's a privilege. On the other hand, my mom, who was Chicana, did not really believe in this, in code switching. She didn't like going back and forth. She said, we brought you up to speak good English or good Spanish. Why are you doing this? But my grandmother, who's 97, Eunice Chavez, code switches all the time.
Hmm. Now, so, do you tend to think in Spanish or in English?
In both. I dream in Spanish, I dream in English, I dream in both. I also dream in other languages I don't speak, like German sometimes. But my thoughts go back and forth.
Well, I'd love to get a taste of this. Could you read something for us from Killer Crónicas?
Sure, be happy to. Do you speak Spanish or understand Spanish?
I don't speak Spanish. I can pick up the odd word here and there, but I don't speak Spanish.
Right. I've actually presented this in front of students and other audiences who are really, really English dominant, and they say they get it, so let's give it a try. Okay, so this is Glossary Crónica, and I wrote it on 22nd of January, 2004, my sister's birthday last year. Me han pedido que me explique aquí. I mean, que explique mi lengua, my use of language, my odd oral transcultural ortografía. My idioma is of the... Bueno. Mi lengua is a hybrid. No way, that's too pomo. Trendy. Demasiado Latino studies. Been there, done that. A ver, mi lengua es un palimpsesto. How's that? Sí, eso está mejor. My tongue is a sedimentation of... Okay, para explicar estos mis flights of fancy, tendría que empezar por decir que soy, it is, my language, cual homing pigeon on acid. Porque I list, it circles back, flashes para atrás, wildly inappropriate, really, to the last port en el cual eché ancla. In other words, para captar la antaño annoying and now oh so entrañable aspiration, that high tirando a nasal, melancholy, apocalyptic whine que caracteriza el Río de la Plata, writing in Los Angeles, actually a little before, still in Buenos Aires, pero sabiendo que me quedaba poco. Tan poco tiempo, looking out my warped glass third-floor balcony window hacia el jardín botánico, I began to transcribe an H, where the S is just a whisper, just a breath down there. Esto. ¿Quiere? Explicar. O ponía la SH instead of Y or LL.
para transmitir la realidad fonética de los northern suburbs de Buenos Aires, like ya, lluvia, te llamo luego, ever daddy's girl, supongo, estudiante de la tradición oral. Heredé su crackshot ear también. I can't not write it like I hear it. Esta mi chicana code-switching life right here en la cuenca de Los Ángeles. Simón Mano, Califas, Órale vato, carnal. You know what I mean? That's from the first one.
Oh, that's wonderful. It really does sound like poetry. It's so rich.
You think?
Yeah.
It's I think it's kind of dense, especially if you don't have a lot of Spanish, or on the other hand, English. I tried it in Argentina, and when I was first there, to my monolingual Argentine friends, they would get kind of upset and say, habla castellano, speak Spanish, you know. And by the end of my stay, I stayed there 13 months. If I spoke to them in straight Spanish, they got annoyed and asked me to code switch.
So when you were writing that, when you wrote this book, how did you decide when to use Spanish or when to use English? I mean, how did you decide which words would be appropriate?
That's a really good question, and it's not. I this is going to sound kind of. I hope not very New Agey in California-y, but I didn't decide at all. It decided on me, or decided for me. This is when I'm writing. The words just choose themselves. Generally, people will tell you that when you're code switching orally, your dominant language predominates, and you sort of switch back and forth when you feel some kind of linguistic pressure. But my students in my Spanish classes now, writing their essays in Spanish, often will include a word in quotes in English, a word they don't know how to say in Spanish. I tell them, this is not Spanglish. This is not it. It's not just, you know, when a word is missing. It moves back and forth really fluidly.
But are there certain words that you think just sound better or mean more in one language rather than the other?
That's absolutely true.
Well, give me an example of that.
Let's see. For example, a couple of words that I said, like, that are very part of Calo or of kind of Chicano dialect or even street language, like carnal really means sort of blood brother or carnala, blood sister. And that sounds hokey in English or kind of strange. But in Spanish, it connotes something very warm, very close, better than pal or friend or something. So I don't think to translate that. I would just put that in Spanish. There's lots of other words, but they also mean something personally to me. Extrañar means to miss. In English, it sounds like strange. Mm-hmm. You know, extrañar, it sounds like strange. But I prefer that word. But also in my book, I often do faux or deliberately bad translations. At the very end of this little glossary chronic I didn't read to you, I'm a little paragraph talking to the reader, and it says, you know, this is an invitation to dive into this texto intersticial, this interstitial text. Go on, lánzate. Now, lánzate means dive in, you know, throw yourself in. But the last sentence says lance yourself, you know, which makes my sisters laugh a lot because I've translated deliberately badly like this since I was a child. You know, I just do it without explaining.
Now, my sense is that you're somewhat resistant to using the word Spanglish to describe what you're doing. I mean, you've used this phrase code switching.
Right. That's just a more linguistically precise Spanglish. Lately, it's been used a lot in marketing, I think. Also, you probably know, there have been a lot of debates about this, a lot among the intellectual, academic community, and even among U.S. Latinos and Chicanos. They don't like Spanglish, and they worry that it's even could constitute an impoverishment of the Spanish language of Don Quixote, for example.
Why is that? Why do some people resist this?
Because, well, I'm not wanting to speak for them. I don't believe this. And in a way, I wanted my book to prove that a literary language could be created using switching back and forth between two languages. And that's why I'm really happy that you said it sounded poetic to you. But many detractors of Spanglish think that, in fact, bilingual speakers, especially in the U.S., tend to just grasp the first word that comes in, you know, whether in English or Spanish, and make up words. A typical example, and I personally have never heard this, but a lot of detractors say that Chicanos, Latinos say, voy a vacunar la carpeta. I'm going to vacuum the carpet. And the word carpeta in standard Spanish means folder. I'm sitting here looking at one right now, you know, like a manila folder. And vacunar means to vaccinate. So that to them, when people make up and sort of play with language in a way that's very practical, and I've never heard that phrase, but it's repeated at conferences, voy a vacunar la carpeta, people, Latinos that don't believe in Spanglish, throw up their hands and say, oye, that's terrible. Listen to how awful that sounds when the real words for them exist. Well, the real words exist if you brought up and lived solely in Madrid or in Guadalajara or in Mexico City or, you know, in La Habana, something different happens between and among languages. I'm speaking not only about the U.S., I also lived in Pretoria, South Africa for almost 3 years, about 18, 19 years ago, and found a lot of the same code switching and languages in contact between English, Afrikaans, all the African languages in a kind of a lingua franca, and it was wonderful. I started participating in that as much as I could, and it felt very, very, I didn't feel at home in South Africa under apartheid, but linguistically, it was very exhilarating.
Could you leave us one last taste from your book, Killer Crónicas? Could you read something else?
Sure, I'd be glad to. This one is, it's the first little chapter, first crónica, which is a chronicle, right after the glossary one. And I wrote this just when we returned from Argentina, mid-August 2001. It's called Mini Playera Reentry Crónica. Walking down a dimly lit Venice Beach street late at night, después de ver una bad, artsy MTV-like Brit movie, Sexy Beast, con Ben Kingsley in Santa Monica. La calle crowded con little Spanish-style refurbished bungalows, teeny tiny, pero tan expensive, owned by movie grips, bit part actors, parentheses, Julia Roberts recently moved there, close parent, surfers, teachers, other professionals. All of a sudden, un olor que no había sentido en más de un año rises in la coastal breeze and hits me. No, it strokes me full in la cara. Sage. Oh, it's a North American Southwest. Oh, salvia, tan green and subtle and gorgeous. Eyes smart with tears and I wince. Sigh. I'm back. Here. Honey, I'm home. Without you all, amigos, poetas, amigas. What's the difference? Ay, where am I?
Susana Chavez Silverman reading from her memoir in Spanglish, Killer Crónicas. Chavez Silverman teaches literature at Pomona College in California. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Anne Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Living La Vida Spanish, number 130B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.